So hi, this is Gavin from FE News. I'm here today on another of our unpacking podcasts. Today, we're going to be unpacking reasonable adjustments in the apprenticeship and skill system. And I've got the great pleasure to be joined by Chris Quickfall, the CEO and founder of Cognosist. How are you, Chris?
Hi, Gavin. I'm very good, thank you. And really pleasure to be part of this.
Oh, and thank you for joining us. Chris, can we unpack what are reasonable adjustments, particularly if we put that into context for apprenticeships and skills?
So a reasonable adjustment is really defined as an activity where you're making an adjustment under a certain process, but that adjustment doesn't compromise the original intent, and therefore it's deemed reasonable. And if it were to compromise original intent, then that would be an unreasonable adjustment and it wouldn't qualify. So for example, if it was, if you were sitting with somebody in an oral exam and that person was going to ask you a question, it's reasonable for that person, for the person being examined, to say, can you repeat that question? Or can you say that question in a different way? But it's, other activities might be unreasonable.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think what's interesting for the FE and skills sector is we've got a little bit to learn from other areas of education when it comes to reasonable adjustments, particularly for apprenticeships and skills. I know you've just completed your white paper, and I thought there was some really quite interesting. It's not many times that I laugh and I cry on a report. It's a bit. I don't think that's an unusual one for me. But there was one of your opening lines on the report for your white paper was from DfE research from 2018. So that's recent for sort of DfE, really. Is that 25% of FE learners and apprenticeships, they stated that non-completions were disabled, was the actual words that DfE said. Can we unpack that a bit? Because that's a high amount of learners that weren't that were non-completions. So could you sort of explain what that could, where they're coming from with that?
Yes. And I haven't got all the background to DfE's statement on that, because a lot of that wasn't made public. And there's a lot of misunderstanding around what is the difference between difficulty and disability, for instance, especially if that's cognitive. So I think what we're trying to say there is, if you, they have done some analysis to determine that 25% quotient. And if you look at the population at large, and depending on different types of subjects, for instance, a one in four type of population that qualifies as having a hidden learning need of some way, shape or form is very, very typical. I studied mechanical engineering at university, and 40% of us were diagnosed with some form of learning difficulty. So you can see that it's not uncommon whatsoever to have high population density of learning needs within certain subjects. And I think what the DfE have really recognized in that report is that somehow in the learning journey, activities that are or are not being taken are disadvantaging a cohort and causing that cohort to drop out. And the real question is, what are we doing or not doing? Which means that we're introducing additional barriers to people who probably face them in mainstream education anyway, have chosen to come and say, that didn't work for me, I'm keen to do an apprenticeship, so I don't have those challenges. And yet we're reintroducing the same challenge. And that's the type of thing we've got to get rid of.
Yeah, 100%. Another question, and I think it then leads to the one I really want to ask, is what would you say is the real difference then between a learning disability and a learning difficulty? Because like you said, a lot of people are going on to work-based learning routes because maybe the academic route isn't for them. So how can we sort of, you know, scale it back? If it's this higher proportion, like on your mechanical engineering degree that you studied, surely that's the case on other qualifications as well. So how can we then start to strip this back, see where these barriers are, and how can we then all work together to try to overcome those, basically?
Yeah, so I'd unpack that initially by looking and saying, we're going to break that into two parts. So the first part is, what is the need? And the second part is, what is the impact? So if I focus on need, what is hidden learning need? What is learning difficulty? And there's no clear-cut definition on difficulty versus disability. that's really black and white. There is grey in between. So to do that, I'll just talk about how we've got to this point. So late 1800s was the first sort of professional analysis on cognition, where they were trying to do performance-based assessments. And the theory was that there's smart people and there's stupid people and there's people in between, but effectively we have one mode of intelligence. The results from that weren't as expected. So it came up with a model called dual intelligence. We thought, there must be two types of intelligence because we didn't get just a smart-stupid ratio here. Over the years, we've done a lot of analysis and realized there's a lot of different types of processing that the brain undertakes. And the brain is stronger or weaker at different types of processing within the same brain and within that brain compared to the population at large. And there's differences in our accuracy of processing, and there's differences within our speed of processing. And there's this thing called multiple intelligences, which we recognize now. So this science was quite well progressed, and then we had World War I, World War II, where they were able to do analysis on people that had severe head injuries, lost parts of the brain, for instance, and try and figure out what does that part of the brain perform. And then up until 1980, when the MRI was invented, putting people's brains inside of an MRI machine and really seeing what's going on without any invasiveness. Not only proved a lot of the things that they understood beforehand, but really just accelerated the science of neuroscience. So that was about 40 years ago, a few years after MRIs was fMRIs, which just meant we had more detail on doing that cognitive analysis. So now we're in a position where we really can get a lot of data about the brain. And that data is modeled using statistical analysis. And there's two books globally that control and reference this. So in the US, they have the US and a lot of Asia Pacific adopt a thing called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual version 5, DSM-5. And the World Health Organization and Britain, we adopt the International Classification of Diseases version 11, ICD-11. So both the DM-5 and the ICD-11 are going through this process they're called coalescing, which means they're trying to join those two books together so we have one uniform understanding. But roughly, to understand the difference between learning difficulty and learning disability, is a broad brush approach is that a learning difficulty is not associated with anything intellectual, and a learning disability has an association with intellectual difficulties. And where we define this is we use a normalized distribution, where we have the norm or the mean, and then you have a standard deviation, and then that standard deviation mathematically is 15. And then if you're one standard deviation negative to the norm, which is around about 16% of the population on whatever cognitive process is being measured, then that qualifies as a difficulty. If you're two standard deviations negative to the norm, it qualifies as a disability. Then that's within one process, one cognitive process. Another cognitive process, let's say we map, for instance, 8 cognitive domains, and we build up a model of that individual's cognition. If some processes are performing much faster or much more accurately than other processes, and the difference between those scores is more than 1.5 standard deviations, this also qualifies as a difficulty. So for instance, I'll give an example. We may find, everybody's familiar with dyslexia. So the challenge, if we were going to map someone's cognition, we were going to say this person's dyslexic. We're not going to say the dyspraxic or the dyscalculic or they've got dysgraphia. So there's 4 dys boxes. We would want to map that individual's score. And let's say we find out that, 6 of their domains are operating at a score plus 1 standard deviation to the mean, but 2 are operating negative 1 standard deviation to the mean. So we've got, in total, a difference of 2 standard deviations. We would come along and say that's a spiky profile. So it's actually operating with both peaks and troughs. And the peaks and the troughs are more than 1.5 standard deviations apart. Therefore, it's spiky, and therefore we can qualify it as having a learning difficulty. And if the troughs were below 2 standard deviations, then we would say, and it may also be a learning difficulty as well.
No, that's really, really helpful. More detail than I thought he was going to say, actually. That's like fantastic. I've got a real understanding of that, and hopefully the audience has as well. And it sort of leads into, before you did your degree, you didn't probably understand that you had a neurodiversity issue. What does it mean around that sort of unintended, yet a very considerable barrier for people if people have a neurodiversity issue and they just don't understand that they have? How can we as a sector start to remove those barriers to support learners through? Because there's some interesting statements in the white paper here around those that were likely to complete particularly their apprenticeship. 68% perceived there's a lack of support from the provider in particular, and also from also looking at this from the training side, from the employer as well. 68% is high. You know, that's really, really high. And that would make you think that it's got to be, there's an unidentified challenge there. So how can we as a sector start to look to how to remove these?
I think a really good question, because it goes back to the previous one, which is what is a need? And then most crucially, what is its impact? And if you find, if I go back to myself, for instance, so I wasn't aware I had dyslexia until third year uni. And all throughout education, I was regularly failing at anything involving language, non-mathematical language processing. So I couldn't spell my name or do the alphabet all the months of the year when I was a kid. So I was the last one in class to be able to do that. I would spell words correctly, but I'd put letters backwards. And then the teacher would tell me that I'd spelled it incorrectly. So I'm looking for spelling mistakes, when actually I should be looking for a symbol mistake. So, and then this continues on. So dyslexia quite often comes with super phonological difficulties. So the act of processing symbols, let's call them letters, some sort of hieroglyphic component, recognizing that symbol's sound, getting that sound and holding it in the short-term working memory, whilst you get the next letter and its sound. Sometimes when you put two letters together, it actually changes the original sound. So you might have to flip those sounds in your short-term working memory while you're doing that. And then you finally get to the end of the word and you've got a complete sound. Keep that in short-term working memory as well. Now continue reading the rest of the words, doing the same process. And then when you get to the end, assert meaning to that. So that's called phonological processing. So a lot of dyslexics have difficulty with that act. To compound that, there's quite often something called visual interference. So people think dyslexics, the letters jump around and things like that. Actually, dyslexia has more occurrence of phonological processing difficulties than visual interference. And visual interference is the things that we typically see maybe on social media where there's a video of letters jumping around. But actually, they may not move. It might just be inaccurate processing. So my letters don't move particularly. I get a bit of depth perception, but there's no movement. If it moved, I could probably figure out what's going wrong. But it doesn't move. But what it does is it incorrectly encodes a letter. So I'll read a word that isn't on the paper. And I might read a similar word, or I might just read a nonsense word. If it's a nonsense word, I know it's not a real word, and I can go back and check it. So I've got no way to, very limited ways to recognize if I'm reading the right thing or not. So I have to. That causes speed of reading. It also means in an exam, for instance, I've always been told that I'm amazing at answering questions that were never asked. But that's because in that type of exam environment, you're under pressure, you've got time pressures. You're trying to work things out much faster than you would typically work them out. And what I'm doing is just incorrectly processing that. Then I'm taking that process and I'm working on it and I'm answering it. But it's a nonsense task because I'm not doing what I've been asked. Sorry, what was the rest of the question, Dan?
This basically looking at those that are unidentified with neurodiversity, there's obviously unintentional barriers that are put in place by that, really. So it's and then looking back at when, you know, 68% of those who didn't complete their apprenticeship perceived that there's a lack of support from both the provider and also from the employer. So how can we as a sector start to help those that are unidentified with neurodiversity? How can we start to remove those barriers to their learning? Because 68% is a huge, huge, huge amount of people. So how can we as a sector start to identify where there is a neurodiversity issue, and then how can we support learners, you know, fully to be able to complete, basically?
And part of the question is also, how can we do that when you, in a lot of the instances, you're going to be sitting with a learner who themselves doesn't know that they have a need?
100%.
That in itself is really challenging. I think, first of all, it's all about education and awareness. We need to make educators aware that this is actually really, really common. It's all over the place. In fact, statistically, if you look at it, 50% of the population has some form of cognitive diversity. And that's if you take the most stringent view of cognitive diversity. If you actually take it as the definition from the ICD-11 and you use it on statistical modelling, and nobody has a standard score of 100 on everything. So by nature there, everyone's cognitively diverse. We just don't know exactly how diverse. So where exactly is the brain strong and weak and how spiky are other spikes? So then you've got an educator that's got to engage with this person. What sort of clues or cues can we get from a learner whilst we're working and engaging with them? And I've been on a few training courses where we've gone off and we've trained educators on, this is neurodiversity. These are how the domains work. And you'll often notice that maybe someone with this domain might present with this type of behavior. So for instance, one of them might be, dyslexia again, not verbal recall. So I'm not particularly great verbally. I asked you to qualify a question for this just there. But we'll talk about, this is what it means. This is what's going on in the brain. And this is how you can spot it. And every time you do that, one of the things I find amazing is I chat to people afterwards and they'll say, oh, do you know what? I've just been doing this with one of my learners, Sarah. And now I know this is exactly what she's got. She's just got a weakness with verbal memory. And all I'm doing is saying the same thing again. What I need to be doing is I need to be articulating the question in a couple of different ways. I probably need to be using more specific language. And I probably want to be using specific language from different perspectives when I'm talking to Sarah. So that a little bit like a dot matrix printer. Remember the old dot matrix used to go dot, 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 and then they'd go over the same line again, and then they'd go over the same line again. And then eventually the picture's built. But with verbal memory, that's one really good tactic. You give them the information, then just give them it again slightly differently. Give them it again slightly differently. Well, you're building up that colorful picture. So, now I know what you're talking about. I can go off and I can process it properly. But if we haven't built up that picture correctly, and then we're asking them to go off and process it, there's no way they're going to come back with the right response. And if they do, it's probably just not. So there's these types of education awareness we really need to undertake. Then I would say this is really the reason why I built Cognisys. So from my own personal experience, having gone off and had a paper-based assessment, which is really, really expensive. These things are £800 per head. They take about 3 months to organize. It's a 2-hour test. You've got to wait 2 weeks for your report. You get your report and you can't read it because it's pure cognitive neuroscience. So then somebody else has to get paid to come along and interpret your report for you. So you're 6 months down the way before you start to understand how your own brain works. And then you still don't know what to do with it. So which is, I wanted to see, can I drop cognitive brain profile? Can I drop that from £800 per brain to 10 brains per penny? And then when I do that, can I do the most important thing, which is then what do we do now that we know how this individual thinks and learns? So I truly believe that what we should be doing is we should just be defaulting cognitive profiling, cognitive assessments for everybody. And then we should give that individual information. By the way, this is how your brain's thinking and learning. And this is what you can do yourself on your own behaviors and learning strategies. So I've got millions of learning strategies. And I keep on learning new ones, which is great. And because I know that if I can just process or capture information correctly, then I've got a better chance of being able to do something interesting with it. So I think not just educating the educator, but also educating that learner on this is your brain and this is what you can do about it. And if that educator can then get access to that profile, then you can really understand, I see what's going on here. And I know how to deliver information, and I know what to not do, and I know how long I should cause spaces. I know the short-term working memory, so I can give them more time or less time. And then I think also there's an operational challenge as well, which is, as an organization, what do we need to do to make sure that at point of delivery, that educator has a flexible enough environment to be able to deliver these reasonable adjustments? And then as we're putting that learner through the learning journey and we're educating them, when they're going on to the next part, the assessment, what are we doing to join up that process? So we're providing learning reasonable adjustments in the learning environment. Let's not stop that just before they get assessed. Let's make sure that in that assessment environment, they're equally as empowered to make these reasonable adjustments. And we're removing as many barriers as we can for that individual. And of course, make them aware that this is happening, because we all need to know what's being delivered to support this, so that I can not be that 68% that says actually I wasn't supported the way I should have been supported. So keep the communication there and keep the understanding of this is why we're doing certain things and this is why we're not doing other things.
Oh, that's great. Personalization and sort of reasonable adjustment can be a little bit controversial how you word it, let alone what sort of happens. And so what we're sort of highlighting here really is, after someone understands, you know, if they do have a neurodiversity issue, and it seems like, you know, half the nation will have, you know, something, is how can we, you know, look at personalization and reasonable adjustment for, you know, apprenticeship and skills on like the sort of delivery side, but then what does that mean for assessment? And how do we sort of need to be thinking of that for assessment for learners?
Within the assessment environment, and this is one of the most critical areas, I think, because in the teaching environment, you've got a bit more time to see what works and what doesn't work. But within the assessment environment, that time flexibility may not be there. If it is, it may be something like 25% extra time. But actually, what you're really wanting to do is test this individual's knowledge, skills, and behavior. And if we just take it back to exactly what are we trying to do, then that really easily helps us shape what is and is not reasonable. So for instance, if we've got a learner and they have unusually slow processing speed across all domains, and they're training to be a jet fighter pilot, is it reasonable for you to make an exemption for that? No, of course not. But if they're training to be in healthcare, or the training to be in engineering, or the training to be a software developer, does it matter whatsoever? No, of course it doesn't. So it needs to be reasonable in portion and not compromise original intent. There is the ESFA's reasonable adjustments guidance, which was released about just under a year ago. And within that, there's a matrix, and that matrix has broken down the six assessment modalities against various different, more common learning difficulties, or the impact of those learning difficulties. So then you can have a look at that matrix and say, here we've got somebody with a weakness within executive function. How is that going to impact an assessment of practical skills? Right, well, it's going to assess it here, impact it here and here. What can I do that's a reasonable adjustment? Oh, actually, it's in the matrix. So there's some suggestions there in the matrix. But it's not an exclusive list. People in these environments will know, actually, do you know what, I could probably do this, and that'll help as well. I mean, just building up this deeper understanding, and then having the freedom and flexibility to feel you can introduce these types of adjustments in an assessment is what's really critical.
Yeah, they're very much. I think some people be listening and thinking, you know, adding in personalization, adding in, you know, reasonable adjustments to learners, this is all going to take time. This is all going to take away from me to be able to deliver to multiple learners. You know, in the assessment process, this is all going to, you know, be cost. Is there funding for the sector to be sort of exploring how they can help with reasonable adjustment? And, you know, is there things that need to be sort of looked at, improved to be able to help with this sort of, it's removing barriers, isn't it? It's actually sort of helping. Like you said, I don't want a jet fighter pilot to be sort of given reasonable adjustment, which is, you know, outside of the intended purposes. They've got to be able to think fast, move quick, do all that sort of stuff. But an engineer and a software engineer, you know, doesn't, you know. So what funding is there in place to be able to help the sector with reasonable adjustment, particularly in FE and apprenticeships?
So that's a great question, Gavin, because we get asked this quite a lot. Is there any funding available to do this? And I'd actually say it's one of the great things the SFA has spent a lot of time and effort on. And they've got different funding tranches for this. Everybody's also scared, is there any funding? And then how do I do it to avoid clawback? Is there two real questions? So yes, there's actually some great funding called the Learner Support Funding, called LSF1. The Learner Support Fund is there for anybody with an identified need, and it supports making reasonable adjustments in the learning environment up to £150 per month per learner. And as long as the organisation has identified the need and is making adjustments individual to that learner based on their need, then we can claim that funding of £150 for every month they support that learner with. If that, and by the way, that funding should be enough, I think, for most learners, most sort of what I would term as non-complex. If there is somebody that has more significant needs, and we work with MenCap, so there are learners within MenCap that have more complex needs that need to be supported with equipment or a lot more extra time funding, EAS funding. So your learner support funding can pay for up to £150 per month, or if you map that out, up to £1,800 per year. If the costs are going to go above £1,800 per year, that organisation can apply for earnings adjustment statement, which is a terrible name because it doesn't really mean anything around learning, learning support and learning needs, learning difficulties. But earnings adjustment statement funding will bridge anything from £1,800 a year up to £19,000 a year. So there's a huge amount of funding there if people are aware. And if they have the confidence to, for instance, reach out to us or reach out to your membership organization and just ask, what are the rules that I need to follow to be able to make sure I'm complying and I'm not facing clawback?
Yeah, that's really cool. You mentioned MenCap, and I know you work very, very closely with MenCap. And MenCap have come up with quite a few suggestions with reasonable adjustment. But I know that there's been some things where the FE and skills sector needs to be sort of adjusting things to better help learners and providers to better deliver these. Did you want to sort of talk about some of those barriers that are in place that MenCap have suggested?
Yes, so MenCap have got a great report called Access All Areas. And in that report, they've identified 17 recommendations. And this wasn't just from MenCap, they did a sector-wide research program where people could put their opinions in, which were then collated and formed up into these 17 recommendations. And several of which are actually echoes of the Maynard report into how do we encourage inclusion within the apprenticeship sector. So we're actually being given the same recommendations from different directions. And sadly, at the moment, none of those recommendations are being implemented by ESFA. We're in regular-ish contact with DfE about various different inclusion agendas. And I know the will is there, but it's just not there yet. So maybe we just need to get them to speed up and take these recommendations seriously. We've got a lot of apprentices that either aren't coming onto courses, should be apprentices, but they're not yet. And because probably risk of associated barriers, we've got apprentices that are coming through courses but are dropping out because these recommendations are meaning that these barriers are still in place. Or they're going through their apprenticeship and they're unable to complete because these recommendations aren't in place. So to throw the entire learning journey from pre-start to post-completion, these recommendations will help, but sadly aren't fully in place yet.
The disadvantage gap is widening. So in your white paper, it's stated one in five young people leave education without basic educational qualifications. That's a lot. Do you think that could be down to unidentified barriers, basically, where the neurodiversity challenges haven't been picked up or identified in schools? Do you think that could be due to that, Chris, or is it? Are there other factors that are in play here?
There's definitely other factors in play. It's a really nuanced environment. I imagine with a lot of really diverse issues, not just cognitive, there'll be socioeconomic, there'll be home environments, there'll be health. But without a shadow of a doubt, 100%, I'm convinced that hidden learning needs will play a big part in that. And speaking from my own experience, my early years in primary school, I basically accepted that this education thing's not for me. And I'm out, that's it, I'll focus on sport. But I'm not very good at the education environment. And my mom is a teacher, or was a teacher, by the way. So she was really, really keen on pushing me back in. You know, education, 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 she kept on saying. This is how you're going to better yourself, or like that. And I ended up getting into maths. So that was the one thing I could at least scrape by in. And then went on to study engineering. When I was identified as being dyslexic, I sort of looked back and joined up all the dots and said, well, yeah, I was incredibly slow on some activities, but not slow whatsoever on others. If I hadn't had a mother who was an educator herself and really valued education, I would have wanted it. Well, I did want out of education way before I was going off to higher education. But without that strong parental guidance, I don't think I would have been in gone anywhere near higher education. And I think we're just repeating that. I mean, 20 years ago, I was in primary school, or secondary school. And we're moving a little bit, but we're not moving a lot. So there'll be kids going to school today that are having exactly the same experience at seven that I had at seven. And we're a generation apart now. So without a doubt, I think there's the lack of us grabbing this at an early stage, recognizing it and doing something about it, is causing downstream issues throughout society. Yeah, I can't remember the study, but there was a really interesting study done in, I think it was Finland. And there's a cognitive process called executive function. And that is, it's executive because it sort of pulls in information from all the domains. And it's what separates us from dogs and cats and rabbits and things like this. And it's because we use information we already have to come up with strategies, to plan, to forecast, to recognize consequences. And that's your executive function. In analysis of people for blue-collar crime in Finland, they found out that it was very unusually, like three or four times more people in prison for blue-collar crime that had impairments in executive function than there were in the general public. So you can statistically model someone with, determine that someone with executive function difficulties at five may end up with higher risk of being incarcerated. And the critical thing here was if they're in a low socioeconomic group. So actually what it's meaning is that if you've got an executive function impairment and you're not in a low socioeconomic group, something happens there that means that you downstream from education, you become a contributing member of society. But if you're in a lower socioeconomic group, so something doesn't happen there, or something else happens, and you have a higher probability of going a different way. So I think that research from Finland just goes to show that this is really impactful. And if we get it right, we could do great things. And if we get it wrong, which we currently are, then we live with the consequences as a society.
Yeah, hugely. Education and FE in particular gives so much second chances to people, also helps them with social mobility, the whole levelling up agenda. And I think you've really hit the nub of it there around that research from Finland with, executive function difficulties or disorder is obvious, isn't it? Once you then scale that back and see that they can't see the consequences to their actions or can't sort of see what's down the track. And I think it's really interesting in your white paper around, particularly talking about this executive function around, could this be a way for educators to be able to spot people that have got executive function difficulties where if they're, you know, there's certain patterns and traits. So I think I think there'd be a really cool follow-up podcast around helping educators spot the signs really of maybe that difficult learner that they're thinking is just being a pain is probably got an underlying neurodiversity challenge which we may not have, no one spotted before, and it could be, it's on them to be able to surface that and bring it out, and then they can then open up this whole new world for that learner. And I think that's just something which I think we as a sector need to really, really embrace. We are the sector that offers opportunities to people, and I think what your white paper here is highlighting, Chris, is a number of issues, not just about to help people with assessment, but also it's about to help people, you know, progress, and the whole social mobility issue, the whole area around progressing in their sort of their world of work, really. Chunking that down, is what would you see is one of the main things that the sector can do right now to be able to look at overcoming barriers, to thinking of reasonable adjustment and overcoming maybe unintentional discriminatory bias or unintentional barriers to learning?
Which I think is probably even more important now that we've got a wave of people that are coming out of employment and into unemployment and reskilling than it's ever been. So I think now's the perfect time to try and address this. I would say one of the strongest things an organization can do, a training provider, and by the way, I've spent 15 years in higher education working within the HE sector. And I came into the further education apprenticeship-based sector. One of the things I was absolutely staggered by is how fast this sector moves. It really doesn't dilly-dally. So when it grabs a problem and it sees it and it understands how to put in place mechanisms, it's phenomenal. It operates at light speed compared to higher education. I'm not saying anything negative about HE. I'm just saying that the proactiveness of this sector is phenomenal. So I think what are the main things you can do? One of the earliest key things I think an organization needs to do is establish somebody that takes ownership of this agenda, some sort of diversity or inclusion champion. So what is that organization doing or not doing? So let's just catalog what are we doing to put in place, make sure that we're practicing this. So very simple things. Are we assessing learners' needs? Not the functional skills, but let's say, are we assessing cognitive assessments? Are we training our tutors in how to spot differences in needs and how to make reasonable adjustments? Have we established relationships with the endpoint assessment organizations? That means when we've identified a need, we can communicate that to that endpoint assessment organization and they can do something about it. And if you get one person to own that challenge, then we'll start mining lots and lots of opportunities within each organization.
Chris, that's great. That's great practical steps for everyone. And thank you so much for your time today. I would love to unpack a few more areas around this. I think we could talk for forever around different areas that we're looking at here, because it's got such a fundamental basis for someone, like you're saying, if we're looking at there's career changes now because of the COVID situation, but they had a terrible experience at school, and they're like, education isn't for me, when everyone is telling them now, you must reskill, you must go back. You know, Boris Johnson's announcement around, skills guarantee for everyone, and like particularly for adults, you know, particularly those that didn't get A-levels, but they had an incredible, A-level standard, it's a level of A-level, but they had an incredibly terrible time at school. What does that mean? Do you know what I mean? And how can we sort of bring that into play, really? And I think it's an incredibly important agenda that you're raising here with the whole sector and helping the sector to raise up to this challenge, really. And isn't it great that we can be so nimble, we can be so fast moving. Chris, thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
I really appreciate it, Gavin. Love coming on and talking about cognition. Anytime.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Why not click subscribe so you can be informed when the latest next individual podcast or podcast mini series from FE News are going to be released.